Today is Wednesday. It's November 30, 2022. This is John Williams. It's 2:39 in the afternoon, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can hear portions of this broadcast Saturday nights on WGN Radio at 8 p.m., and I'm on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
And I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the victorious and valiant publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, my Substack newsletter.
Eric's still crowing about the Michigan victory over Ohio State, and Brandon Pope isn't even here to take his lumps.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that, but I'm sure Brandon will be back at some point and I'll have a chance to remind him.
Yeah, even if it's 6 months from now, Eric's going to go, hey, Brandon, how about that Ohio State game?
Yeah, by that time, Ohio State will have beaten Michigan in basketball and volleyball. But very exciting game, and I thought about Brandon a lot during the game.
So. I'll bet you did. Let's open with the Chicago mayoral field, which is set. And then Heather said, oh, not so fast, Bucky. Isn't it set? We're at 11, Canada.
We're at 11. So now we are in the challenge period. So candidates have until December 5th to look at their opponents' petitions and decide whether they want to file a challenge against those petitions. So candidates for mayor have to file at least 12,500 signatures from registered Chicago voters. The rule of thumb is that if you want to make the ballot and be sure that you're going to make the ballot, you want to turn in three times that amount. So somebody like Willie Wilson, who turned in 61,000 signatures, he told reporters, and somebody like Jesus Chuy Garcia, who turned in almost 50,000 signatures, are probably okay. But if you're somebody like Cam Buckner, who turned in 24,000 signatures, or somebody like Roderick Sawyer, the alderman of the 6th Ward, who wouldn't tell reporters how many signatures they filed, you're probably in a little bit of a pickle. Because your closest opponents, people who agree with you on some issues or who are similar to you in some way, will be looking to sort of clear out the field. And they do that by kicking you off the ballot, or at least trying to.
What do you make of Brian Hopkins, the alderman from the 2nd Ward, challenging Lori Lightfoot's signatures of all people?
This is the time of year that I sort of hate the most, because there are lots of people telling lots of reporters that they're going to do lots of things. And until you actually do something, I don't know that it's news. So maybe Alderman Hopkins does challenge Lori Lightfoot's 40,000 signatures. You know, I don't know, but it's cheap and easy and free to say that you're going to do it, but it is much harder to actually get in there and do it. And this is really painstaking work. You have to go line by line by line to sort of say, look, this isn't good and that isn't good. So might he do it? Sure. But, you know, if Lori Lightfoot turned in somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 signatures, that means that you have to get rid of more than 30,000 signatures. Yeah. And that seems possible, but unlikely.
Well, I'll tell you what, there is not enough money in the world to get me to do that. Like, hey, I got an idea. I'm going to give you $20 an hour. You go in that room. Here's a magnifying glass.
How many people do you have to pay to do how much work to go through 40,000 signatures? I mean, how many hours are we talking about? How much money are we talking about? Who would fund that? Hopkins isn't going to dig into his own pocket to fund that. He's not going to sit there and go line by line himself.
Well,
right?
He could fund it because he doesn't have an opponent. He's one of five city council members who is assured of re-election and a new term in May. So, but this is, it's going to cost, under any circumstance, thousands of dollars. And the question is it worth it? Yeah. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. It will be really interesting to see whether Willie Wilson's campaign challenges Jamal Green's petitions for the second mayoral election in a row. In 2019, Jamal Green ran and Wilson challenged him and kicked him off the ballot. Jamal Green was furious, and both of them are running again after both endorsing Lori Lightfoot in the runoff. And it will be interesting to see if history repeats.
Do we know how many signatures? I saw the name for the first time, Johnny Lagalbo. Is that how you say his last name? He's a truck driver for the Department of Aviation, a freelance counselor, he describes himself. I'd never heard the name, and I was trying to keep track of everyone who was
freelance counselor describes everyone I know's aunt.
So
tell me about him. Yeah,
he was a surprise file at the deadline, or near the deadline. He has a GoFundMe out there, asking people for money because he says he lost his city job because he refused to be vaccinated at against COVID-19. If you remember, all the way back in 2014 or in 2019, 21 candidates filed to get on the ballot, only 14 candidates made it. So there will be a winnowing. Also, who filed, Frederick Collins, who's a Chicago police officer who has a long history of excessive force and settlements that the city has paid because of his conduct, is also running, along with what I'm calling 9 major candidates, including Lori Lightfoot, Chewy Garcia, and Brandon Johnson.
Boy, this would be an interesting case for ranked choice voting, wouldn't it? We wouldn't need to worry about the runoff. And it would be so interesting to see the dynamics of where Lori Lightfoot would fit in, because as a very popular first-term candidate, she became a not super popular politician, but is still probably high enough in people's minds that while they might not vote for her first, they'd vote for her second or third. And she could, in each successive counting, climb up and up and up. Ranked choice might actually, I'm just thinking out loud here, benefit a Lori Lightfoot. It's conceivable that she wouldn't even make the runoff, be one of the top two candidates, which would be embarrassing, if nothing else.
It would be truly wild, truly wild.
Yeah. What ranked choice voting is sometimes called instant runoff voting. And we have a runoff, which is really nice, because without a runoff, you would have somebody winning this election with less than 30% of the vote, which I think is undemocratic and strange. I like the system we have now. I'm a big fan of ranked choice voting. I think it should be done. But I will take a runoff situation like this, where we're going to have the top two candidates. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen. When you and I were talking on the radio, John, we're talking about the fact that Paul Vallis is probably going to be the only white candidate on the ballot, which could be very interesting. I don't know. Again, we've mentioned this before, whether how much voters can take race and ethnicity into account anymore when they're voting. Certainly, the African Americans dominate the city and county government right now. But that could be a really interesting dynamic. And you're going to have in the list of I don't know exactly what Heather's list of top nine are, but you've got a couple of aldermen who might be on the race. You've got a Democratic state
representative,
Isaiah Camp Buckner. You've got Brandon Johnson, who has a whole bunch of union endorsements behind him. And of course, you've got Willie Wilson, who has a base of support. I don't think that Willie Wilson can ever be elected mayor of Chicago, but I could certainly see him making a runoff if the field is crowded enough, because he's going to get 10% of the vote, maybe a little bit more, given all the money that he's given away. I don't know. It's going to be I don't know really how to handicap this field. I would agree with the implication that Heather makes, that we're going to lose probably, what do you think, 4 or 5 out of this field?
Maybe.
I mean, Jamal Green, I don't know how many signatures he turned in, but he had problems last time.
He turned in just under 30,000. So he's a little bit above what I would consider
safe.
Safe.
He's a little below what I would consider safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but who's going to challenge him? I mean, the question is who wants him off the ballot? Because there are certainly instances in local politics where someone clearly didn't have enough signatures, but nobody challenged him because they kind of wanted him on the ballot for one reason or another.
Old school Chicago politics meant that you were looking to be the only woman on the ballot, or the only Black woman on the ballot, or the only Black man on the ballot. And that was really sort of what prompted many challenges in years past. So if you remember all the way back in 2019, Tony Preckwinkle challenged every single Black woman who ran for mayor, including Lori Lightfoot. Now, Lori Lightfoot withstood that challenge, and that clearly shows you sort of how, you know, some candidates approach this. I think I've said this before. I think I have said it. The question that I have is this year going to be like determined by race? And I'm not sure that it will. I think that this perhaps will be one of the first races in Chicago history for mayor that breaks down not along racial lines, but along ideological lines. So you have two very prominent progressive candidates in Chewy Garcia and Brandon Johnson. You have Mayor Lightfoot, Lightfoot sort of in the center. And then you have Willie Wilson and Paul Vallis, mm-hmm. who have a lot of name recognition, who are running as very conservative candidates. So the theory is that, you know, of course, two of those candidates could make it into a runoff. And if you want to lock up all of those voters, you want to be the only person in that lane. Now, Brandon Johnson has more than 42,000 signatures. That is probably enough to keep him on the ballot. What happens there? There's a lot of unknowns. I'm just not so sure that this race breaks down like others break down, because I think Chicago politics is in a very different position than really it's ever been in.
Well, if 10 of the 11 candidates are persons of color, then it clearly is. And I don't want to make too much out of it, but where are the white men in this case? Or is there nothing to that? It's just a one-off. It just didn't turn out that white men percolated up into the process and became viable candidates. Well,
there were so many white men who were talked about running, and you just kind of go through. Mike Quigley was talked about, Ernie Duncan was talked about, Bill Conway, the guy who ran against Kim Fox last time was talked about. Tom Tunney was talked about. Pat Quinn, Hopkins himself. Some people were talking about Jesse Sharkey running. I mean, all these people, Joe Ferguson, maybe even the former inspector general, although he never expressed much interest in it. But there was just all kinds of talk about all these candidates, and they all took a powder. And I'm not exactly sure why. Some of the excuses were fairly lame. Pat Quinn wanted to spend more time, I don't know what, passing petitions or something for
Well, Pat Quinn also knew he wouldn't win.
I remember Heather reminding me, reminding us on that there was all kinds of talk about Judy Friedland. Is that how you say her name?
The former Chicago building commissioner. She never ran.
She had a committee, and there was all kinds of, but nothing official. And you reminded us, Heather, that people can make all kinds of noises and paw the ground all they want, but they're not running until they turn in those petitions. And in fact, we never heard again from her.
Well, speaking of white male politicians in Chicago, Ed Burke is in the news this week. Heather, catch us up on that a little bit.
He will leave the city council not by the pine box, the ballot box, or the jury box. Instead, he, as I saw on Twitter from my friend Eric Wallenis, said he is executing an Irish goodbye, and he didn't turn in signatures, so he will not be on the ballot for the 14th Ward for the first time since, wait for it, 1969.
Wow.
Holy. I love that invocation of the ballot box, the pine box, and the jury box. That's one of Burke's famous sayings, right?
Absolutely.
There are only three ways to leave the city council, and Burke found a fourth way. So
yeah. So I mean, of course, he's under indictment, and he will stand trial in November 2023 on 14 charges of racketeering, bribery, and a variety of corruption. He has pled not guilty, but of course, he has really been a shadow of sort of his former mm-hmm. powerful selves mm-hmm. ever since May of 2019. But I think it's really important to remember that even though Ed Burke got reelected after he was arrested, he basically torpedoed the campaign of everybody around him. So Susana Mendoza, who ran for mayor, never really recovered from her association with Ed Burke in the mayor's race. Tony Preckwinkle made it into the runoff, but lost every single ward after being sort of tangentially associated with Ed Burke and sort of being a beneficiary of a donation that he allegedly extorted. It's really hard to overstate how just strange it was that Ed Burke was essentially left the only person standing in the rubble that was left after his arrest. And I don't think that it is a stretch to say that had Ed Burke's offices not been raided 4 years ago this week, and he was arrested and charged with extortion, that Lori Lightfoot wouldn't be mayor. It's just a direct line.
Are you fascinated by the fact that Ed Burke's wife is Ann Burke, the now former Illinois Supreme Court Justice? I think there was a quote in the news this week where she said, yeah, we don't talk, we go our separate lives about all of that, but just what an odd relationship that must be. over the last few years, maybe for 40 years. But he is the picture of things people don't like about politics and maybe corrupt politics. And there she is, one of our most honored justices in the state, married to each other.
Well, and it wasn't just that. For many, many years, Ed Burke was a leader of the Cook County Democratic Party, and he was essentially in charge of slating judicial candidates. So there is no doubt that he wielded his power to benefit his wife's judicial career, which isn't to say that she wasn't accomplished in and of her own right. You know, she helped found the Special Olympics with the Kennedy and Shriver family. She, you know, worked as a teacher and a special education recreation leader. So she certainly has her own career. But the fact that their careers were so intertwined, I don't think it should surprise anybody that they're essentially retiring at the same time. But it is going to be one of those only in Illinois stories that we're going to tell people 5-10 years from now, and they're going to look at us like,
what were you guys doing? I just always imagine the scene at breakfast where they're clinking their cups and nobody's speaking, and then she throws up her hands and says, what were you thinking? But it wasn't just one incident. It was a career like that. So maybe that was just the way they managed their affairs, and they kind of look the other way. But it just always struck me as a little stinky.
Wasn't good. I wanted to add that I think the idea that Burke is graciously retiring is not quite accurate, because his ward was redrawn, and he lost several of the places where he is really strongest in that ward. And I think it would have been a pretty tough road to reelection for him, even without his legal problems, the way that ward was redrawn. Now, I think they probably redrew that ward knowing that he didn't have the power to stop him from doing it. And, I mean, and so it's all kind of connected. But I doubt he would have won re-election. I think he would have been beaten pretty badly in that if he had run again. So I don't. This isn't like some sort of noble retirement gesture. I think he realized that the writing was totally on the wall.
Is he going to go to jail, Eric?
Prison, yes, I think so.
Heather's not allowed putting a marker down on that issue.
Well, she's an objective news.
Her silence speaks volumes.
So I would say that the Department of Justice loses very few trials, right? Just the overwhelming number of people who go to trial on charges like this are convicted. However, Ed Burke has literally millions of dollars in campaign funds that he can and will use to defend himself. And he's already spent $3 million on his defense. He has another approximately $9 million left in his campaign account. He can use every dollar to finance that defense. So he's not, I don't think, going to go down quietly, right? He's given no indication of that. And it's going to be a long, fraught trial where he is going to argue, if filings of his attorneys are any guide, that he was simply conducting politics and business as usual in the city of Chicago, and that it wasn't illegal, and that he was simply doing what he needed to do to represent his constituents. So is it a slam dunk? No, but it's also not a long shot either. And I will remind you that Alderman Patrick Daley Thompson is currently in prison on charges that were much lighter and had much less evidence to support them. And he was convicted by a jury in the Dirksen Federal Building, where Ed Burke will stand trial, in a matter of hours. I barely had to get time to get lunch before that jury came back.
George Ryan, the former governor George Ryan, had Dan Webb, who was considered to be one of the finest attorneys in Illinois, were defending him, and they tried to pull this politics as usual defense. I don't think that Governor Blagojevich, when he went to trial, had the greatest attorneys working for him, but they made the same politics as usual defense. That doesn't tend to fly. That's what they tell themselves as they are doing their, you know, as Blagojevich called it, horse trading. But and Heather's exactly right about the Department of Justice here, the U.S. Attorney's Office. They have a very, very good record when it comes to political corruption cases, and you would be a fool to bet against them. It may be years before this case resolves. I think it's scheduled for trial about a year from now. Is that right, Heather?
So it is scheduled for trial in November 2023, and I expect that trial date will stick because it has already been nearly 4 years since he was charged, and all of the pandemic delays are over. Mm-hmm. Both sides have had ample time to examine the voluminous evidence in this case, which I kid you not, includes 9,000 wiretapped phone calls, and we learned this week several videos of Ed Burke and Alderman Danny Solis, who is an unindicted co-conspirator in all of this corruption. So it's going to be a really long trial. And a lot of the conventional wisdom was that Ed Burke would run again, if only to be able to negotiate some sort of agreement with prosecutors. Hey, I'll plead guilty, and as part of my punishment, I'll step down. That will no longer be a chip he has to play, which I think surprised some onlookers.
Has that chip ever been successfully played? Do we know?
I believe so. I believe it has. But, you know, it's also one of those sort of pieces of received conventional wisdom that may be more true in theory than in actuality, mm-hmm. because they've spent millions of dollars gathering this evidence against Ed Burke. I would be very surprised if they're inclined to sort of let him go without a significant prison sentence. Although I will say this man will be 80 years old when he faces a jury. And that is no small achievement in age. And that will make the jury, I think, at least cognizant of whatever sentence, you know, is determined could result in a life sentence.
That was the argument that Dan Webb made to the sentencing judge at his trial. It was like, if you put this man in prison, it's a life sentence. Look at his health profile. Of course, George Ryan's been out of jail now for what, a dozen years.
This conversation does remind me, though, Eric, of the times you've said that you don't think that your campaign funds should be used in your defense for, you know, obstruction, some sort of criminal charge. And it does seem kind of offensive that an alderman would have a $11 million war chest, and that B, they'd be able to use it to bail themselves out of crimes that they've committed, I mean, or are charged with. That's not, when I get to be king, Eric, we won't allow them to do that. How about that?
Well, why don't you run for state legislature and then you can submit that as a bill? I'm guessing that most politicians would not vote for it because they all wonder what's going to happen. I think that those kind of funds, if I'm donating to a candidate, it's because I want that candidate to advance my policy positions. I don't want to defend them when they are caught with their hand in the cookie jar. And I would support that.
You just heard the phone ping for Mark Maxwell, who I think is joining us now. Mark, I know we're not going to see you in this podcast, but we're going to hear you. Are you there?
Yeah. Hey, guys. How are you? I'm back in Springfield at the state capitol, where they are getting closer to taking up the next debate on the revision to the Safety Act, the end of cash bail coming soon.
How do we slate you now, Mark?
I'm the political editor at KSDK, the NBC station in St. Louis now, but covering Illinois and Missouri politics and the city hall in St. Louis as well.
Was that part of the attractiveness to you? I mean, other than the fact that you're just a brilliant, terrific reporter, but you could learn the Missouri scene, but also be their Illinois guy, huh?
Thanks for saying all that. But yeah, there's definitely an intrigue in Illinois. You really get an indoctrination, if you will, in the blue state politics, but there's a whole other side of the political spectrum in the country that you definitely get a stronger dose of that in Missouri, the red state side. And so both states, I think, are pretty polarized in their directions. But, you know, you've got a supermajority of Republicans in Missouri and of Democrats in Illinois. So getting the other side of that exposure has certainly opened my eyes to a different style of politics at the state level.
You wrote a piece that described the Safety Act. Did you read all 700 pages of it?
The first version? Yeah, believe it or not. Now, when I say I read it all, people might know when there's existing law and they write new parts into it, all the stuff that doesn't have underlined or stricken through, that's all old language. So you kind of skip ahead. It's sort of cheating to say you read all 700 pages. You really just read the changes that are in there. But yeah, All the changed parts. Yeah, I read all that.
I think there was a lot of hope or wonder if the legislature would make some of the changes that reflected the concerns people had about the Safety Act. I know a lot of the criticism that was put up about it was garbage, but some of it did seem to merit a little attention.
One safe way to say it was that the critics raised points because there were parts of the law that were clearly confusing or vague. And the supporters of the initial version said, well, an aggressive prosecutor could use their discretion and go to a court and make the case that this person should be detained before their trial. But the law didn't clearly lay the framework or the pathway for that to happen in every instance. So here, the Democrats have come back to the drawing board and clearly outlined the pathways that a person charged with, say, second-degree murder, which is a really rare charge right out of the gate, or kidnapping or arson. You know, some of these lists violent crimes that you saw on the social media memes or circulating on the internet, people were saying these types of violent defendants are going to be let out of jail without, you know, before their trial, and everyone's going to be at risk. And you saw the warnings of a looming purge law in Illinois. Well, I think there was some clear sensitivity to all of that. And so you're seeing Democrats put that language specifically in the bill so anybody who comes to read it can no longer make these egregious or inflammatory claims that everyone's is going to be purged in Illinois.
Is it still then the onus will still be on the state's attorneys and the judges? The state's attorneys will have to make a more credible case, and the judges are going to have to better consider whether or not this person should be detained. I've wondered at times if that was one of the reasons that so many state's attorneys didn't like this bill, was because they're going to have to work harder on these cases.
Yeah, I think even if you just take all the politics out of it, there is that accountability side, right? Under the old system, you could say, well, you know, we set a pretty high bail at $500,000, and a state's attorney can just sort of throw their hands up. Well, I don't know what to tell you. They came up with the money and they got out. Now the decision or the responsibility for that falls squarely on their shoulders and the shoulders of the judge. But there's a number of tools where it expands the definition to say if someone's a willful flight risk. It used to be a very narrow set of circumstances. Now it says if you've demonstrated in the past or in the present any ability to evade law enforcement, or if you've tried to avoid a court date or anything like that, that means you could be a willful flight risk, and that's a reason they can detain you. If you've shown in your criminal history that you've been violent in the past, that you've stalked someone, tried to harass someone, if you've been a domestic offender, if you've been hurting people, basically any kind of harm that you've been inflicting on someone, a judge can look at that and weigh that fact against you as they decide, is this person going to have their liberty before their trial, or are they going to be held in jail for weeks or months before we get them before a judge and before a trial?
Mark, during the gubernatorial campaign, Darren Bailey, the Republican, frequently made note of the fact that 100 out of 102 county state's attorneys in Illinois were opposed to the Safety Act, one reason or another. Do you know if any of these changes have placated them, have brought them around to supporting the Safety Act now?
Well, there's an ongoing lawsuit from a number of those. I think 50 or 60 of them have sued and challenged the constitutionality. And a portion of, I think it's too soon to say, right? One of the House Republicans, Patrick Windhorst, who was a state's attorney in deep southern Illinois, is still reading this new draft of the bill that just came out today. But closer to your audience, Senator and the new Republican leader in the Senate, John Curran, said, yeah, it looks like this version of the bill would directly respond to that lawsuit. He suggested it wouldn't necessarily make the ongoing legal challenge moot. He suggested that case might continue, but that in changing the law, the Democrats would strengthen their position in court and go before a judge and say, look, what we're doing here is constitutional, and we can show our work.
Do you get the sense that there was any bipartisan buy-in on these language changes? Did this make the Republicans in the legislature happy?
They certainly had an influence in pressuring this action. But as it stands right now, talking to Republicans in the House and Senate, there's not a big appetite to come help the Democrats here. It looks like Democrats are going to have to fix this on their own. And at least that's the sense at this moment. Things could always change. The Senate appears poised to go ahead and pass this over to the House maybe early tomorrow. And then before they leave, the House hopes to whip the votes to get it back to Governor Pritzker's desk.
Well, I presume that it'll have the votes, right? I mean, it had the votes the first time, so there's no reason that would change now. Is there, Mark?
Well, I don't know. In the Senate, it looks like the votes are there. That's the sense we're getting. It seems like most of the people close to the process feel like the votes are there in the Senate. In the House, you know, there's less certainty at this moment. I mean, there's some folks who still want to learn the issue. And again, it's a higher threshold in a veto session. You don't just need a simple majority. You need a super majority to get it done. So any kind of dissension in the ranks could really force them back to the drawing board and have to bring in some Republicans. I think there are some arms being twisted even now to get some Republicans to try to consider voting for the bill. So that is a clear sign that they don't feel very confident all the House Democrats are on board.
Mark, as you step back and take a look at this, like from 20,000 feet, the way the Safety Act was introduced and passed and seemed to have these pretty plain defects in it, that it did not follow sort of the normal course of legislation, did it? It was done too quickly, and everybody seemed to admit there were problems with it. Just what's your take on just the whole process of how this was done? Was it according to Hoyle or not?
Yeah, it might be a little bit cynical to say this, but it looked like there were a number of people, take state's attorneys, prosecutors, police, who just weren't going to agree with really any number of these changes from the outset. If they came to the table or not, the conventional wisdom in this building was they're not going to go along with this. So there was at one point a decision to basically stand up, walk away from the table and say, we're going to ram this thing through basically as a negotiating tactic or as step one in the process. Then this would be the fourth time that the House and Senate have come back and changed this law to be more sensitive to their requests. So in effect, by passing this through at 3 a.m. or whatever it was back in January of 21, that forced law enforcement and prosecutors to the table to say, okay, now you've changed the law. Now let's look at the things we can do to make this a little bit more amenable.
Well, we're talking about the no cash bail component of the Safety Act. There were other parts of it, many other parts, and some of them made pretty good sense to me that didn't get much attention, maybe for obvious reasons, because they made pretty good sense. But can you just talk to us about other components of the bill, and are they in flux as well?
Sure. One of those is police body cameras. The biggest places like Chicago and Cook County have to meet those requirements sooner, and then the smaller and smaller the local governments get, they get more and more time to satisfy it. So the smallest towns in Illinois have until, I think, 2025 or 2026 to be fully in compliance with police body cameras. And this latest version of the bill provides more funding for not only the police cameras, but the data centers and the storage devices that would keep the video footage on hand for review. That's one of those police transparency changes that's there. There's still ongoing discussion about supplying some of the extra funding for the counties and the prosecutor's offices that would have to change the way they go about detaining people before their trial, because that whole process is going to change. There's any number of things that changes the way a police officer can pursue a suspect and can, you know, advance chokeholds, for example, and basically says, you know, in trying to protect people from crime, don't create new victims of violence while you're in the process of doing so. That's the sort of the moral aim of the bill, and it creates a stricter standard for the rules of force.
Yeah, isn't there something about the other officers need to intervene if they believe that one of the officers is doing something that's in violation of the person's rights? Is that what you were referring to, or am I thinking of something else?
That was definitely in the first version. I'd have to go back and double check. I'm not exactly sure in this moment if they might have softened some of that language in a follow-up. There was some discussion around that, but certainly in the first iteration of the bill that passed almost 2 years ago now, they did say that. If you're an officer standing by witnessing, like one of the officers that might have watched what happened to George Floyd, the video of that, you would, under this law, have a legal obligation to step forward and alert an authority to stop it from happening. And so it kind of put more of an onus on each person to have individual responsibility in the collective outcome.
It's 32 days before January 1st, and then we were told all through the campaign that the gates are going to open and they're going to go running out of Will County and they're going to start hurting bunny rabbits and driving school buses and doing all kinds of terrible things. What do we expect happens on January 1st, Mark?
The House Democrats are right now circulating a 2-page fact sheet that sort of distills the 308-page update to the Safety Act. The very first thing they say is a category called the transition. So what happens on January 1st? And they draw a clear red line. Everybody in the old system that was arrested under the cash bail system will stay there, with the exception that they have the opportunity to try over the next 60 days to transition into the new system, to do that, they have to go before a judge. They have to go through a whole hearing. There is not some automatic button being pushed that opens all the jail cell doors. And they make that clear. On January 1st, anybody arrested on or after would go into the new system. So they try to clearly spell that out to put to bed this myth or this fear-mongering that all of a sudden the jail doors are going to fling open.
That's not what it said in that newspaper on my doorstep, the Cook County Daily Times Herald Sentinel or whatever it was.
I'd say you should ask for a refund, but I have a sneaking suspicion that paper was worth every single penny you paid for it.
I didn't subscribe.
One of the interesting things to me is that, you know, the website here in Chicago, CWB Chicago, you familiar with that, Mark?
It's like a police blog.
It's a police blog. It's a blotter. It's basically a blotter blog news site. And they keep track. They count everybody who has been released on felony bond or on home monitoring who commits or allegedly commits a heinous crime after that release. And that's been going on for several years. And the count is significant. It's daunting. The system clearly makes mistakes. And there are clearly situations where you can't hold somebody for a certain crime forever and you have to let them out and maybe they'll do something bad. So this is already happening. So what I'm saying is that so that next year you're going to see this, I think, a lot of attention, a lot of hysteria even attached to people who are let out under the same circumstances that they would have been let out before. People who have paid, who now would have been able to buy their way out, who are now released on other circumstances who commit these crimes. So that this isn't necessarily going to make a change, but every crime that's committed by someone who is not affected by this cash bail thing is going to be held up as an example of why this isn't working.
The tension point just shifts there, right? From the prosecutors to the legislators. And that moves the tension from the police, perhaps, to the prosecutors. And there's going to be police that say, "Hey, Prosecutor X in Kane County, why did this person get out?" And they're going to have to answer for that. These are elected positions. These are elected prosecutors. So they're going to have to answer more for how aggressively did you pursue detention in this case? Why did you let this person out? There's going to be a set rule book that every prosecutor can play by. And you'll see the aggressive ones be more successful in detaining people. And you'll see the passive ones who have a different mindset or a different approach, they might not press for detention in every case.
And previously they were able to just say, well, we'll set it at $10,000. This guy didn't have $1,000 or $10,000, so I don't even have to work that hard on the case.
And I think that's all the big part that's changing. They wanted to take the money part out of the system.
Well, of course, the judges are the ones who set the bail amount. So,
all right, Mark, well, listen, any last notes from you on this before we let you go?
No, just, I think I would watch tomorrow. It looks like all the action is going to be bottled up for the final day. You know how they do things in Illinois, wait until the last minute. Nothing motivates like a deadline.
Is it radically different in Missouri? Have you noticed any big difference between the way our state runs and Missouri runs?
The thing you noticed right out of the gate is they have an active filibuster. So, and they use it. They can, if you don't like a bill, you can hold, if you're in a super minority, you can stand on the floor and wave and shout and read and hold something up until the rest of your caucus finds an agreement, and they actually use the filibuster in maybe the most effective way I've ever seen. Certainly different than the U.S. Senate.
Like Mr. Smith goes to Jefferson City.
Kind of like that. Yeah, it's quite bizarre. We don't have that same action in Illinois, but that's the biggest difference that I noticed.
Nice to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks for having me.
Missouri's gain is Illinois' loss. He's good.
Yeah, we got to have him back. He's he really knows his state politics. It's pretty good.
Laura Washington said in an opinion piece this week, and she joins us sometimes. She couldn't join us today, which is too bad because I wanted her and Eric to box a little bit about the viability of soccer in America. She wrote that soccer is a common thing, that the fire or soccer would be a good marquee tenant for Soldier Field if the Bears leave, and that we can all say bye-bye to the Bears and hello to soccer. I must say, I really enjoy soccer when I watch it. Is it a little like, I don't know, motorsports or opera or haggis? If you grow up with it, you know it and you like it. But if you didn't, then it's a real hard taste to acquire. That doesn't mean that it's not a terrific thing or that the rest of the world's interest isn't genuine and
the haggis of sports. I like that.
Well, and that our thumbing our nose at it is is just a cultural bias that we would and maybe even should appreciate it more.
You know, soccer is the sport of the future, and it always will be in the United States. That it has never really caught on. Kids have been playing soccer for 40, 50 years now, and everyone says, oh, these little kids are going to grow up into big soccer fans. And it just doesn't happen. You have the Chicago Fire playing in front of about 15,000 people or so at Soldier Field that holds 60,000 people. Yeah, and that has been kind of true for a long time. And people will watch the World Cup, but they don't really get, it's just like people watch the Olympics. And you know, women's gymnastics is not a thing most of the time. One little segment every 4 years, people are really wild about figure skating and downhill skiing. And once every 4 years, people are really into soccer in the United States. Now, around the world, it's different. And it's totally cultural. You're absolutely right. It's what you're raised with. It's what you are exposed to as a spectator sport. I mean, my thinking about this, and the reason I was kind of chiding Laura about it, was that I've been hearing this from commentators and columnists and pundits for years about, oh, soccer's going to take, American football is on the decline, soccer is on the way up, and it's just not true.
Okay, but I want to see two graphs. One is the browning of the American population, and one is the interest in soccer. And I'll bet you that those run a parallel path. That is, our population changes, soccer will too. So if it's premature to say soccer's here or soccer's coming soon, soccer is coming, right, Eric? Like 40 years from now, soccer will be bigger in America. Flag this podcast and come back to it in 62? But that sounds insane. But I think I'll be right. Soccer will be bigger in America in 2062. Eric,
Heather will be the only one of them, to adjudicate the well. I want to, Heather. Your girls must play soccer, right?
They do not. I have.
They play football, Eric. They helmet up and they play American football.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
No, pardon me.
I would argue that the same argument you're making for the eventual popularity of soccer is the same argument that the Democratic Party made after Barack Obama's election in 2008, that as America became more diverse, more Black, more Latino, that Democrats were assured of somehow winning a supermajority because the Democratic Party was, of course, what they were going to vote for as they became American citizens and voted that way. And I would just say that in every possible opportunity, that demographics have never proved to be destiny, really, in any aspect of life. So I am less convinced that soccer is the wave of the future.
Only Heather would make that segue. That was brilliant. But they did vote for Barack Obama twice, less the second time than the first, but he did win re-election.
But then the idea was that the Republican Party could never win another presidential election without significant support from Black and Latino people. And certainly Donald Trump did not have anywhere near enough support from Black and Latino voters, but he had overwhelming support from white voters and enough Black and Latino voters to be elected almost twice. But not quite.
Well, that does make Barack Obama a pivot point then, because it is the reaction to Barack Obama's presidency that galvanized Trump's conservative base, which included a lot of racists.
Absolutely. You're 100% correct.
So maybe there is still something here. That is, it's a hiccup. It's a speed bump. But maybe it does indicate the staying power. I mean, they see it coming is what maybe Barack Obama's legacy is right now. Although, really, what is Barack Obama's legacy right now? I wonder what his stamp is on American politics in 2022. He sure didn't come out a lot for Joe Biden or other candidates as a retired president. He did in some instances, but he wasn't a staple on the campaign stump.
Well, active in the 2022 midterms than he was in the 2020 presidential election. And I think the fact that Obamacare is sort of now an accepted and immutable fact of American life, I think, is probably going to be his longest and most significant legislative achievement beyond sort of the cultural importance of being the nation's first Black president. But it's impossible to tell, you know, what his legacy is going to be. It's impossible to tell what anybody's legacy is going to be because, you know, to badly paraphrase Hamilton the musical, you know, legacy is a seed that you plant that you don't get to see grow. And, you know, that's you know, has to be how we all approach it.
He gave some terrific speeches in Pennsylvania to promote the candidacy of Fetterman, for the most part, the Senate candidate there, that were just very stirring speeches and just reminded me of how much I miss Obama and his rhetorical skills and his just his personality, his political gifts and so on. The analogy with is an interesting one that Heather makes. And one of the things that has happened with this, you know, this demographic inevitability for the Democratic Party that they didn't really count on is that some of these, you know, Latino voters and Black voters, that they are not necessarily rock solid liberal Democrats, and especially in the Latino community, it's a culturally conservative demographic. And so, and what you may see here also is that when people come to the United States and they'll realize that American football is so much better, it's so much better sport than soccer, so much more interesting, so much more intellectually stimulating. And that's my take on that. That you may find that rather than having them change the way our spectator sports, that the beauty of our games, violent and awful as they are, is going to convert them to our.
Why? Because we score more points in our version of American football.
I think American football is just. I mean, I will always have the caveat of the brain damage and all that. I know that, but every play is like a chess game, you know, and you've got all the defensive strategists and the offensive strategists. And then you finish the play and everyone analyzes what happens. And then the next play happens all the speed, the size, the strength, the skill in every thing. I mean, I never really played. I played in junior high. So, and John, you were a star kicker at a major university. So
Joliet Junior College. Go Wolves.
I yield to your love of football here. But I mean, I think football is just an amazingly great game.
It's a fun game. It is our passion. But I wonder if it's possible that you don't know enough about soccer to make those comparisons. Well, the chess match component, for instance, maybe you don't appreciate that, in fact, there are strategies that are going on there. There are schemes, and they're just lost on Eric Zorn.
Oh, no, I believe there are strategies and schemes. I just don't think they're as compelling. I could be wrong, but this is also – it's cultural, right? I mean, there is this cultural – I mean, football – American football stops and starts all the time, and – if you don't like, I mean, and football is a continuous.
It's a track
action.
Meet for 90 minutes. I mean, I know that the guys on the pitch, as they say, and I know nothing about soccer, but I watch it on TV once in a while. But those guys are athletes, man. And when you do watch them dribble the ball through traffic, that's an extraordinary thing. It's truly artful, don't you think?
Absolutely. They're incredible athletes, and they often do incredible things, but not really all that often, given that they're out there for 90 minutes.
Yeah, I know. We need to make the goal bigger. I used to think that if the thing was about five times larger, that it would up the scoring, but evidently they've thought these things through, and they like the sport the way it is. Chicago's very own Nick Fuentes, the racist white nationalist, continues to make news this week. He and Kanye West, Donald Trump, and Trump's 2016 Florida campaign director had dinner at Mar-a-Lago recently. Mr. Trump is saying that he did not know who Fuentes is or what his views are, that he was an unexpected guest invited by Kanye. Trump has not apologized, however, for gracing Fuentes with his presence. It reminds me only slightly of the Access Hollywood tape in the run-up to the 2016 election, in that it looks bad, and everybody said, oh, this is his doom, or blah, blah, blah. You know, traditional Republican stalwarts said, oh, we got to cut from Trump here. And then it goes away. Don't you think that's the way this thing's going to go, too? So it looks ugly, but it's Trump. That's the way it goes. Neil Steinberg's piece today in the Sun-Times says much of the same thing.
Yeah, I thought Neil's piece was quite good on that, refer people to that. It's not going to damage him because nothing ever does. This is the people who were so upset about the fact that Barack Obama began his political career with a fundraiser at the home of Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn. are now just completely fine with Trump dining with Kanye West and Fuentes, and they always will be. And I don't know how you can reconcile that, but you just realize that this isn't going to, I don't think, going to make any kind of difference to anybody.
Do you believe that he didn't know who Fuentes is? Because that's his escape hatch here.
I can't believe that Secret Service and his advanced people would allow someone just to walk in and sit down with him at dinner without figuring out, like, who is this guy? Well, that's not credible.
We know a little bit more about what happened based on reporting from NBC News that essentially Fuentes was in a car with Kanye West, who was on the list, and that the he got waved in, and Kanye said, "Hey, this guy is with me," and they all got waved into the president's presence. Originally, Kanye was supposed to meet with the president in the library, but reporting shows that the president wanted to show off Kanye West to the other guests at Mar-a-Lago, and Nick Fuentes was along for the ride. All that to be said, I don't think it matters, because President Trump has made four statements after this dinner. And in none of those statements, after being informed of Nick Fuentes' truly horrific opinions on the Jewish people in the Holocaust, has declined to distance himself from those beliefs. So that's the long and the short of it to me. I think that we as a news media spend too long, too often, and too much thought thinking about whether it's going to hurt somebody or not hurt somebody, rather than grappling with what it says about our society, that a former president of the United States sat down, had a meal with a man who believes the Holocaust was essentially a hoax, which of course we know it was not. And he is still the front runner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination.
I know what you mean by that, but I wonder if all of the pushback from major Republican politicians, I don't know where the Wall Street Journal checks in on all this, but here's the last paragraph of their editorial. Mr. Trump isn't going to change, and the next 2 years will inevitably feature many more such damaging episodes. Republicans who continue to go along for the ride with Mr. Trump are teeing themselves up for disaster in 2024. I wonder if mainstream Republicanism pushing back is going to impact his campaign or his candidacy in any way.
So he's in a stronger position now than he was when the Access Hollywood tape that you mentioned was released. And as you said, that was not a deal breaker for any of the people who voted for him, certainly once and most likely twice. And I think it is, there's no evidence to suggest, as you said, that this would be a deal breaker.
Of course, there's a Ron DeSantis now, and there wasn't the last time. Who was the person that would have challenged him most in the previous election? I'm thinking of Ted Cruz.
I think what happened to former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, I think, is probably indicative of what happened. Remember, Paul Ryan was outraged by the Access Hollywood quote comments. He disinvited President, soon to be President Trump from a rally and appearance alongside him. And then once President Trump won, he worked with him to achieve President Trump's legislative agenda, even though he, sought to break ties because it was so beyond the pale. I think what the issue is that, and I think if something very similar happened when soon to be House Speaker, likely maybe Kevin McCarthy, came out to greet the cameras outside the White House this week, where he erroneously said that President Trump had denounced Nick Fuentes four times. Of course, he did no such thing. So the Republicans have either been, have been in large part silent about this. And
Mike Pence wasn't. Mitch McConnell wasn't.
So what you did not hear Mike Pence or Mitch McConnell say is that there is no place for this in the Republican Party, and I will vote against Donald Trump if he is the nominee of our party.
They said the first part, but they didn't say the other part.
Well, they denounced anti-Semitism. They did not say, I denounce Donald Trump eating dinner with two avowed anti-Semites. They did not mention his name. They made vague hand-waving gestures toward the awfulness of anti-Semitism, but in no way linked Donald Trump to that anti-Semitism and said that it would be a deal breaker for them in the 2024 election.
So do you think them or the likes of them want Donald Trump to be the front runner?
I don't know what they want in their hearts, but what they have done repeatedly is to sacrifice everything and anything for the possibility of either winning elections or currying favor with Donald Trump supporters.
But the midterm would tell you that that's not a smart bet now, right?
And if they had learned that lesson, you would not have seen Kevin McCarthy say, once I'm speaker, our top priority is to launch investigations into Hunter Biden and to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, because he is, you know, allowing the border to be unpoliced, which is factually not true, and was the centerpiece of their agenda in the midterms.
But that's Trumpism. But I wonder if you could have Trumpism without Trump. It just seems to me like Donald Trump at the top of the ticket is not the smartest or safest bet for Republicans in the next election.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you're supposed to know. I'm asking you all these questions. Well, that's interesting, Heather. I appreciate your thoughts on that. That's an interesting analysis. Eric, you were a little quiet there. Any last words from you?
No, I think it's absolutely correct that Republicans are flirting with renominating Donald Trump at their own peril. He is a loser right now, and you can spin it all you want, but he has really cost the Republican Party quite a bit. He probably cost them the Senate this time, and I think that they are afraid of his base for no good reason, that his base can be converted to supporting a different candidate and probably will be. So this is just yet another example of why they need to distance themselves, and maybe there'll be a few Republicans peeling off at each time, and that's how it's going to happen. So,
Heather, it's good to see and hear you again.
Yeah.
Eric, the same. Any Christmas cookies for me? Any seasonal stuff you want to pass along, Mr. Z? Are you guys performing anytime soon, by the way?
Oh, we're doing the Songs of Good Cheer at the Old Town School of Folk Music on December 9th through 11th, and there's still a couple tickets left for that. Mary Schmeek and I have been doing that for 24 years now. We've got a great cast. We've got a great lineup of holiday songs to sing along with, and I invite anyone to go to the Old Town School website and see if there are any seats left.
I want you to busk. I want you to just take your fiddle out on the street sometime, Eric. Did you ever do that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I've done that a lot. Not in recent years, but yeah, sure.
And does that work? Did you get some coin when you do that?
Not a lot, but yeah. I mean, I like play square dances now occasionally and things like that. So
I always wonder when those people that are performing their music, if they're performing it more for the thrill of having an audience, albeit a passing one, or if they're really trying to make money in the process, because it must hurt your feelings to see people walk by and not drop a quarter in.
A quarter? No. You know, there is some of that. I mean, people who do it seriously, really, who do need the money, are really, you know, they don't. It's not about getting an audience or getting appreciation. It's really about getting the money. And you know, the times that I've done that, it's just basically been, you know, just to entertain people and play. Because you know, I sit around and play with people all the time for nothing. And so doing it on a street corner is just a, you know, a slight variation on that. So
there's some buskers in Chicago who are really good too. Do you ever go by somebody with a PA and sometimes just a microphone with a backing track? And some of them are terrific.
Oh yeah, and I always try to throw a dollar in their case when that happens.
I do too.
I encourage that. I really think people who are really good. I really like. I know how it is also for people who are trying to make a living as musicians.
Heather, did you guys ever cover it that way? Like, does a Channel 11 send a camera crew out to record some of the top hits in the streets of Chicago or sometimes in the subway platforms?
It sounds like a great segment for Jeffrey Bear.
Yeah, no kidding. Heather Sharone, Eric Zorn. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another pot on you next week. Okay, guys. Nice to see
you. Thanks, Ruby. Great to see you, Heather. Thanks.
Thanks, Heather.
Bye.
Good stuff.
It was fun.
Yeah, good job.
Yep.
See you guys.
Thanks.
Bye, Mr. Z.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.